Okay, so today's topic, on the paper it said freedom, responsibility, and purpose, which I will kind of stick to it towards the end. But what I want to do is actually, leading into that, I want to share with you something on the parsha this week. Not because I want to share Dvar Torah on the parsha, which is also a good thing, but I just want to share, I think it's a fundamental idea, and we can link it into, just to finish off the week, what we're sort of finding ourselves now in. So there's a pasuk in this week's parsha, if you have a look at your handout in the yellow on the Hebrew, that says, Vayikra Yaakov el Bonav. This is towards the end of Yaakov. In this week's parsha, Yaakov passes away. And it says, Yaakov called his sons, Vayomer, and he said, I mentioned this yesterday briefly, but he says, Osvu ve'agid lachem, gather around and I will tell you, Eis asher yikra eschem ba'acharis hayomim, what's going to happen at the end of days. Okay. What does that mean? Says Rashi, in the little highlighted thing here. Says Rashi, the famous Medrash, Bikesh Yaakov legalis esakeitz. Yaakov, actually what he wanted to do at that moment is to reveal to his sons the Kates. Kates is a reference to when Mashiach will come, the end of time, right? The Kates, opportune times for Mashiach to come. So basically the simple pshat is he wanted to reveal to them when Mashiach is coming. When he stalka mimeno shchina, and the shchina, the divine presence, departed from him. So he realized, according to one explanation, he realized that Hashem doesn't want him to do that. Therefore, v'hischil oimer dvarim acherim. Therefore, he started to say other things. Okay. If you go to the other side of the page, there's a piece here in English from the article that they mention an interesting medrash, which I'll just mention, by the way, because it's just a nice little thing. It's the origin, actually, this episode is the origin of Shema and Baruch Shem. I mean, Shema and Baruch Shem, not Baruch Shem, but Shema Yisrael is a paragraph in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu told the Yidden in Sefer Dvarim before they went into Eretz Yisrael. But actually, the origin of Shema and Baruch Shem, because there's a question of where Baruch Shem comes from. This is the famous Gemara, it comes from the Malachim, but according to this Medrash, it comes from something else. And have a look at the, just we'll read it through, have a look at the highlighted part. It says that Yaakov thought like this, when the Shekhinah departed from him, so it says he thought that perhaps one of them was unworthy, a new Yishmael or Esav. Right, because up until now, they knew that Avraham Avinu had a tzaddik for a son, but he also had a Yishmael. Yaakov Yitzchak had Yaakov, but he also had Esav. Yaakov was mitosai shleima. Yaakov's family was perfect, but suddenly when the Shekhinah went away from him, he thought, well, maybe there's an Esav here or something, right? So he asked them if this could be so, and what did they do? They responded. They said, Shema Yisrael, which then meant, listen, Yisrael. Yaakov's name was Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We're all Hashem, God Hashem is one. We're all completely on the page. We believe we're perfect. We're all there. To which Yaakov was so relieved that he responded. It says, right? So he says, and they said, it says the matter, just as there's only one God in your heart, there's only one in our heart. Upon hearing that the reason for his lapse in prophecy was not due to the shortcomings within his family, Yaakov exclaimed in gratitude. So he wanted to praise Hashem. So he said, Baruch Shein Kwe Malchusa Lo Ilam Vod. Right? Just by the way, there's a fascinating B'nai Yisoschar in this, which is not a topic I want to go through, but I'll mention it anyways. That if you take the Shvatim, right, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, all the sons of Yaakov, and you put them all together, you will find that there's all the letters of the Aleph base, with the exception of four. Ches, Tes, Kuf, and Tzadik. So it says that Yaakov Avinu was looking at the Shvatim and he wanted to tell them the Kates, he wanted to tell them that the end of time, and the Shechina went away from him. So he thought maybe that there's Chet, there's sin. One way of spelling sin is Ches and Tes without the Aleph. So Neiswasra says, then, so he asked him, maybe there's something wrong, to which they answered Shema Yisrael, and he said Baruch Shem. So he realizes there's no Ches, Tes there. That's why there's no ches tes in all the sons of the Shvatim, because he realized there's no chet, there's no sin, they're all 100% tzaddikim. So then he realized that Hashem doesn't want him to reveal the kuf tzaddik, the kates. So there was no chet, and there ended up also being no kates. And that's why those are the four letters that are missing from all the Shvatim's name. That's why, just interesting fact, that's why later when the commandment took place to make clothes for the Kohen Gadol, one of the begodim of the Kohen Gadol, one of the clothes of the Kohen Gadol was the Choshen, the breastplate, which had engraved all the names of the Shvatim on it, right? And what used to happen is it had the Urim V'tumim in the first place of Migdash. You could ask questions to the Kohen Gadol, and the answer would be highlighted. The letters of the answer would shine up. Problem is, if you only put the Shvatim, there's going to be a problem, because some answers will contain one of those four letters, and there's no Ches Tes and Kuf Tzadik, which is why, if you actually look carefully at what stood on the Choshen, it wasn't just the Shvatim's name, it was also Avram, Yitzchak, V'Yakov, according to some of Farshim, that was in the first stone, was Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Ruvain, and on the last stone, which was Binyamin, it said Binyamin, Shiftei Yeshurun. This is the tribes of Yeshurun, which is a reference to Yaakov, right? So if you're missing those letters, if you have Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Shiftei Yeshurun, you make up the four letters, because Yitzchak, of course, has a tzaddik and a ches, and Yaakov has a kuf, and then Shiftei has a tes. So you make up all letters, and that's why all letters are the aleph base on the Choshen Mishpat. Okay. So that's the Medrash. So Yaakov wanted to tell everyone Mashiach was going to come, and Hashem didn't want him to, so it departed. So in 1981, Toshim Emalef, the Rebbe said a very interesting talk on this Rashi, asked some very basic but obvious questions, and then came up with a very, very novel approach to this whole Medrash that Yaakov wanted to reveal when Mashiach was going to come. And I want to share it with you a little bit, briefly, and then maybe take it from then on to other things. So he asked a simple question. First of all, we need to understand Yaakov wanted to reveal to the tribes when Mashiach is going to come. Why? What was the purpose? Not only what's the purpose, but let's just think about this. And this was the obvious question that I've asked, which could only be asked in later generations. Can you imagine Yaakov standing on his deathbed? He's a tzaddik, he's a novi, talking to his sons. He says, I'm going to reveal to you Mashiach is going to come. And they're all excited. And what does he say? That in Tofshin Peivov, in 5786, which we're in now, Mashiach is still not going to be here. I mean, can you imagine breaking the news? Like, I mean, what's the point of that? Not only was the point of that, there's a great danger that if you didn't know that there's going to come a time when 2025, almost 2026, and Mashiach is still not here, understandably, the Yidden will give up hope. I mean, our hope is Mashiach. We keep davening for Mashiach. We keep believing. We say every day, well, some people say every day, Ani Mamin, Be'muna Shlema, I believe in perfect faith, right? The Mashiach is going to come, and Afapi Shisma Meya, even though he's very, very late, he's not punctual, but nevertheless, I still believe. But nevertheless, we still believe any day, right? We still believe it's coming. And you've always believed that. As Rambam says, that one of the principal, fundamental principles of believing in Mashiach is that you have to, he says, not only you have to believe in Mashiach every day, you have to be mechakel lebiyosi, you have to expect him every day, right? But if the sons of Yaakov find out, and therefore over, as a continuation to that, all the Yidden find out that he's not even going to be here by Tovshin Peivov, 2025, 2026, how can they expect Mashiach every day? And if they don't expect Mashiach every day, they're just going to give up hope. So what could possibly be the purpose of Yaakov telling the Shvatim when Mashiach is going to come? Because it's definitely after today. Well, maybe it's today, Mr. Shem, but after yesterday, right? And then, of course, we have to understand, if he had a purpose, then why did Hashem take it away? Now, there are Mefarshim that explain the following, that actually Yaakov he didn't have intention to reveal it to everyone. He was going to reveal a secret to the Shvatim. They were tzaddikim, and he knew he could trust them. They won't tell anyone, and they won't give up hope. But they won't pass on that secret to their children, so no one will know. We'll continue living in hope. All the generations, mechakel lebiyosi, all waiting for him to come any day. So the Rebbe rejects this answer, and he says, first of all, you never know, you know, the chance of things staying confidential. Okay, we're talking about tzaddikim, we know that, but nevertheless, you know what I'm saying, like, leaks are very common, right? It's a dangerous thing to do. It's a dangerous thing. If you know the secret, it's such a dangerous thing to tell anyone. Even the tzaddikim, even Yaakov's children. Second of all, even Yaakov's children, what's the point? Like, we still haven't answered the question. What's the purpose of sharing that information? Okay, maybe you can trust them. Maybe it's tzaddiki. Maybe they won't give up hope. But what's the purpose of sharing that information with them? Right? So one answer he gives, that we know from Chazal, we say this every day in davening, in the end of the Shira, to be Eimu Vesita Eimu, that we actually know that when the Yidden came out of Mitzrayim, and they were able, if they would have the real schus, the real merit, that we know that actually going out of Mitzrayim could have been Moshiach. Why do we know this? Because we mentioned the third Beis HaMikdash, which is the Beis HaMikdash that Hashem will build with His own hands. We mention it in davening every single day. We mention it in connection, in context of the Jews going out of Mitzrayim. Mikdash Hashem konyinu yodecha, right? And it could have happened, but they had to have a schus. So maybe the pshat is like this. Maybe Yaakov Avinu is gathered around his children. He's saying, listen, in 210 years from now, you're going to go out of Mitzrayim. Make sure that you guys stay clean, like you stay with no averus. It didn't happen at the end of the day because the Yidden actually assimilated and they started serving Avodah Zarah, idol worship, and so on. So it didn't happen. But maybe he was trying to encourage them, hang on, just be completely clean. Okay, that's one pshat. And therefore that would have been the kates, and that was the kates he was talking about, right? However, it's also difficult to understand because just the very fact, the Yidden didn't know they were going to be there for 210 years. In fact, they were supposed to be there for 400 years, right? Even that's a problem. Even that's a risk of giving up hope, telling people, you know, I mean, by the way, when Yaakov Avinu passed away, it was actually a good time, relatively speaking. They weren't yet under slavery, they weren't yet in servitude, but nevertheless, telling them that things are going to happen, you're going to be stuck here for the next 210 years, even 400 years, is also a risk of giving up hope. So, again, why? What was the purpose of that, right? So the Rebbe comes up with a very, very novel approach, and that is the following. The Yaakov Avinu was never going to tell them a date. That wasn't the point. So what was he going to tell them? He's going to tell them the following. We know that even, let's leave Mashiach for a second and let's go to the exile of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, right? We know that the Yidden left Mitzrayim after 210 years. The actual truth is that they were supposed to leave after 400 years. The Gezeirah, the decree of the Jewish people being enslaved in Egypt was for 400 years, right? And there's a very big question. How come they left after 210 years? There are various answers given for that, right? And the answers is, one of the answers is that it was actually the time didn't start from when they went to Mitzrayim. The time started from when they, from even when Yitzchak was born and they became unsettled and travels began and journeys began. And that's when the 400 years starts. If you work it out, that's exactly right. But there's another pshat that's given in the Midrashim and Chazal that was supposed to be 400 years, but there was Koshi HaShibud. There was such terrible slavery that actually wasn't part of the decree that it was accelerated. So we accelerated from 400 to 210. It was brought forward, right? Which, by the way, we hint to in the Haggadah Shel Pesach. This is not, again, it's not part of the topic, it's a nice word. In the Haggadah Shel Pesach, we praise Hashem for keeping His promise and taking us out of Mitzrayim, and we say, Baruch Hu Shechishev Es Haketz. That Hashem worked out the end of time, not the end of time of Mashiach, but the end of time to go out of Mitzrayim, right? And the gematria of the word Ketz is 190. So what does it mean Hashem chishev es haketz? He calculated the Ketz. It means He calculated that He could take off 190 years and they ended up going 210 instead of 400. Says the Rebbe, if that's the case, if the extra level of slavery could accelerate the Golus and let them come out 190 years early, so why can't good things do that? And if it can happen with Golus Mitzrayim, why can it happen with the Golus in general? Why can it happen with Mashiach? So Rebbe's novel approach to this is the following. Bikesh Yaakov legalis es haketz. Yaakov wanted to reveal the ketz means he wanted to inspire them so much with sufficient inspiration that they would put themselves into gear of such amazing connection to Hashem and inspiration. The Mashiach will come right then and there. That's what it means, Chishev Zaketz. Bikesh Yaakov legaloi sesaketz. You want to reveal, Chevri, you want the Ketz? You want Mashiach to come? Now. You can do it now. You can bring Mashiach now. Because there is no actual time. There's a maximum time. It can't go for more than 6,000 years, but right of the world. But Mashiach can come anytime. And actually, what he wanted to actually do is give them such chayah, such koyach, to bring Mashiach right there and then. Sounds like a great idea, right? So why did Hashem take it away from him? See, here comes a very interesting explanation which we need to understand, really ultimately the purpose of Mashiach. So just to paraphrase a little bit the explanation. So we know that there's two types of ways we relate to Hashem. There's two types of ways that Yidden can really be connected to Hashem in a very deep way. One is what we call in the terminology of Hasidus, the Isarusa de Le'ele, an awakening that comes from above, right? Which then activates inspiration that comes from below, that we Hashem sends us a major miracle, He sends us a major thing, we become inspired. Okay. But then there's another one called Isarusa de Le'tate. Actually, there is no inspiration from above, but we work hard to connect. It comes from us, right? And it comes from us in a very deep way, to which Hashem responds. Now the Gemara tells us, Odom roitze bekav shaloi, yoitze metisha kavin shel chaveri. A kav is a measurement of wheat. And the Gemara says an interesting line. The Gemara says that a person would rather one kav, whatever that measurement is, one kav of wheat that he or she themselves have worked for, earned, rather than 10 kavim from a friend. I'd rather have my own kav that I earned more than 9 kavim that a friend gives me. Why? Because when I earn the one kav, it's mine. It's what we call avoda b'koyach atzma. It means it's real. It's actually mine. I earned it. I deserved it. It's me. When someone gives me, it's very nice, but it's a present. It's good. It helps me, whatever the case is, but it's not. I don't have that same satisfaction. I don't have that. It's what the Gemara calls Naham Dichsufa, bread of shame. You just get given things, right? Now, sometimes we need to learn to take, and sometimes we need to take presents, whatever the case is, but it's not that same thing, right? Hard thing to understand in today's generation. We live in a generation where people are very happy for everything to be done for them, right? That's a fact. And that's going to tie into to a very, very important concept, which I want to share with you in a moment. But that's true. Now, when Hashem created the world, why did he create the world? In Hasidic terminology, we learn there's a famous medrash, famous brought all the time. And those who learn a little bit of Hasidus, Hashem created the world to make a dira betachtonim, a dwelling place for Hashem in this world. Right? What does that mean? So let's unpack that phrase for a moment. He wanted to make a dwelling. Hashem wanted to live betachtonim. Tachtonim means in the lower levels, in the type of existence that's the lowest existence that could be. Now, what does lowest existence mean? Hashem's worlds don't work in spiritual worlds, right? It doesn't work like there's top floor, 10th floor, and the 5th floor. It means spiritually speaking. So we know that in Kabbalah, we learn lots of different worlds that Hashem has. Many, many layers of worlds and existence and experiences and all kinds of things. But this is the lowest world. Why is this world the lowest world? Because it's the one that God is most hidden in. It's the one that resists godliness. It's the one that's incompatible with godliness to it on the surface. This is a world where we don't see other worlds. There are higher spiritual worlds where you see bad things, but you see good. You see Hashem. You feel godliness. You feel the connection to God. This is the world. Our world is the world, unless you work really hard. By default, this is the world where Hashem is totally hidden. It's the world of complete darkness. Right? And Hashem said, that's where I want to live. I want to be revealed in the world where I'm hidden. Now, that's good. But we have to take it a step further. Because what he really wants is something different than that. He wants something deeper than that, I should say, right? If Hashem wants to live in this world, he's more than welcome. Let him move in. It's not a problem. He can just reveal himself in this world. It'll be fine. Then the Medrash will have been fulfilled. But the way the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe said it in a number of places, he said Hashem wanted a dira, I'll say it in Hebrew and I'll translate. He said he wanted a dira betachtoinim al yedei hatachtoinim. He wanted a dwelling place in this world, but that the world must invite him. Right? Hashem must invite him. We must invite him. We must invite Hashem into the world, which means we have to work really hard. Right? Hashem's not going to do it for us. We have to invite him to come to this world, which means we have to do mitzvahs. We have to learn Torah. We have to elevate the world. We have to be kind to each other. We have to bring Hashem into this world to the point that not only Torah mitzvahs, but actually goes further than that. We have to work hard to recognize Hashem in everything that we do, to see the hand of Hashem in any experience that we experience. whether it's in business, whether we're eating, we should eat like a Jew, eat with making a bracha, elevate the food, elevate the business that we do. Everything has to be us. And that's a long process and a long journey, and that's what we have to do. Right? And that's the ultimate thing of Mashiach. Mashiach means, what does Mashiach mean in a nutshell? And Mashiach means lots of things. Mashiach means that the world will be good. We daven for Mashiach for all sorts of reasons. It doesn't matter why we daven for Mashiach. But the truth, there's a nice little story actually. There were a bunch of Hasidim once outside the door of the previous Rebbe. And they were discussing, why should we want Mashiach? You know, we daven every day for Mashiach. It's a fundamental of Judaism, right? In the Amidah, there's a number of times we ask for Mashiach. But why? Why do we want Mashiach? It's an honest question we'll have to ask ourselves. I'm not going to do it now. It's not group therapy here. But it's an interesting question to really stop and think, do I really want Mashiach? Yeah. So now we all want Mashiach because a disaster happens, so we need Mashiach. Of course we want Mashiach. But when things are going well, do we really want Mashiach? Don't know. Like, do we really need a Beis HaMikdash? I mean, do we really need to bring korbanos? I mean, is that like a real thing? Like, do we feel a lack? The fact that we don't see Hashem all over, is that a problem for us? I mean, as long as things are going well, if we're well and family's well and we have a parnasa, it's good, you know, life is good. Not now, right now, but I'm saying it's... Yeah. So none of us want Mashiach because we have a pekel, you know, we want it. So it's not a bad thing. We want Mashiach for anything. So the Hasidim discussing this, they were trying to be honest with themselves, right? This one said, listen, I've got to be honest, I want Mashiach because, I don't know, my daughter's not well, I'd like it to be well. Whatever, this one's saying that. And then some Hasidim were saying, that's the wrong reason, we have to work on ourselves to become so godly that godliness actually matters. And then we should want Mashiach because we want to feel Hashem. And one of the Hasidim sitting there was Shmuel Levitin. Shmuel Levitin, the famous Hasid, he had a very bad foot. And as they were talking about this, the previous Rebbe walked out and he said, Reb Shmuel, the Mashiach would come with an foot wären besser. He says, when Mashiach comes, your foot's going to be better. Yeah, so it's true. Mashiach will come, everything will go. And you know, if we want Mashiach, it doesn't matter. We just need to want Mashiach. If we want it, our foot should become better, should be. But truth is, the Rebbe explains other place that we have to also simultaneously work on ourselves. We want Mashiach because we want Hashem to be revealed. Because we want to feel godly. Because that's the purpose of creation. That's the purpose of the entire creation. That the world should be a godly place. But we have to create it. So when Mashiach will come, that's exactly what's going to happen. Hashem will suddenly be revealed, as it says in the Pasuk, in Tanakh, V'niglo kvayd Hashem. Hashem will be revealed, and every flesh will see that Hashem is there. But that means the moment Mashiach comes, that's the moment the invitation is complete. To put it in simple words, right? That means inviting Hashem is now complete, and he comes to the Simcha. So now let's go back to the story of Yaakov, right? No, sorry, before we do that. So let's talk about it again. In general in life, when we have inspiration, we said it either comes from somewhere else or it can come from us. So the first benefit of coming from us is that it's ours. Secondly, it's permanent. We all know, and this is a challenge every time something happens, there's been a tremendous inspiration, right? But the challenge is always to keep it up. Why? Because whenever we have something coming from somewhere else, whenever we come... You know, I'll give you an example. When the Six-Day War happened, it was a phenomenal miracle, right? I mean, the miracles that happened since October 7th too. Many, many miracles, great miracles. But when the Six-Day War happened, it was so obvious because, I mean, there were sacrifices and there were people lost, etc. But for the most part, it was just a most miraculous war, right? And there was a tremendous awakening in the Jewish world. People seeing pictures of people that went to the Kotel, people that had never been before, and so on. Beautiful, right? Did they change? Some of them did, probably. Did they suddenly become a different type of person? Not necessarily. Why? Because inspiration came from outside. It came from above. When we do things ourselves, when we motivate ourselves, when we work hard ourselves, we really work hard when it's very, very difficult, and we earn it, not just being swept away by some inspirational experience, it lasts. It's permanent. We've created a permanence. Going back to Mashiach, therefore, the invitation to Mashiach has when we create our little part, when we write our little part of the invitation to Hashem to reveal Himself in that world, it has to be an invitation that is permanent. Not that I'm in a good mood, you know, like you tell a simcha, if you're in a good mood, you invite someone. Then you remember you have too many people. So you said, actually, no, I'm disinviting you, right? But, I mean, we try not to do that. But we have to invite Hashem constantly. That means our connection has to be constant and growing, but just in the same direction, hopefully, right? Keep on growing. Difficult. I mean, if you don't, it's okay because we have tshuva. It's all good. But We have to create a permanence, but that only happens when we do it for ourselves. So now comes this thing of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu is desperate for Mashiach. All the tzaddikim were desperate for Mashiach. And he sees an opportunity. You know what? I can do this now. I can bring it about right now. He's about to die. There's something special going on. He can inspire his sons. I'm not sure exactly what that would look like, but he bikesh Yaakov legalas esakets. He had the Shekhinah was in his head. He had prophecy that actually he could do it right now. And then the Shekhinah goes away. Why? Because actually had Mashiach come right then and there, it would be beautiful, but it would miss the point of creation. Because it would have been a total inspiration coming straight from Hashem. Because no one would have actually actively invited him to come in. Invited Mashiach, invited Hashem into the world. And Hashem would have had a dwelling place in this world, but not invited by the world. It's dira betachtonim, it's a dwelling place in the lower form of existence, but the lower form of existence had nothing to do with it. It's just been overwhelmed by an amazing revelation from Hashem, and that's not what Mashiach is about. Now, we believe that we've already invited Hashem. And then we'll talk about it, that we need to cry out to Hashem, that we think the invitation is fine, the print is beautiful, the wording is nice, and he can accept. But he hasn't yet. And we have to keep working. But at the same time, demand that we think it's finished. But as long as he hasn't come, we have to keep working, right? So, therefore, that answers all the questions, because of course he wasn't going to do something that would induce them to give up hope. On the contrary, he was going to make Mashiach come right there and then. And that's what it means, legalos esakets, to reveal Mashiach. But then it would have missed the whole point of us, and particularly us, by the way, particularly the lower generations. See, Hashem wanted a dwelling place in the lower world, and he wants the lower world to invite him, but the further away we get from the giving of the Torah, and the lower we are, the invitation is stronger. Because we're on a lower level than the Tanoim and Amoraim of the Gemara, on a lower level of the prophets, right? And yet we still connect. You know, the famous thing that says in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble of all human beings. So everyone always asks the question, what does that mean? Many answers given, but the famous question about, he was very humble, but he knew who he was. He knew he was the greatest prophet. He knew who he was. And false humility is not a good thing. People need to know what they're worth. It's not, right? And he knew. He knew it with the honesty. He talked to Hashem every day. He was the greatest prophet. He gave us the Torah. So what do you mean he was the most humble? So many answers. So one of the answers given is that Hashem showed Moshe Rabbeinu a vision of all the generations till Mashiach, and he showed him us. And it says when Moshe Rabbeinu saw the last generations before Mashiach, he felt humble. Why? He says, because I'm envious of them, because I am a great person. Yes, but I talk to God every day. And I'm Moshe Rabbeinu, and I was born the whole light, house filled with light. Moshe Rabbeinu was on such a level. Of course he was on such a level. He was set up for that. Then he saw a generation that's not set up for that, where Hashem is totally hidden. And the world is filled with distorted values and all kinds of nonsense. And Hashem, it's really dark, right? Especially our generation. We live in a dark, that's spiritually a generation that's, we have physical comfort to some degree, but we actually don't have spiritual success in a way. Yes, there's many yeshivas, we are learning Torah, it's all true. But the hedonism and the terrible values and the loss of, just in general society, the loss of religion and family life and belief in Hashem, it's terrible. And yet he saw people still going to shul and still doing mitzvahs and still learning Torah and still trying to find Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu felt humble, right? That's why this is a generation that's going to bring Mashiach. So that's the answer to the question. That's why Hashem took it away from him, that he shouldn't be able to bring Mashiach then, but we have to work for it and bring it on our own. But this idea, and this is the idea on the parasha. But this idea that the coming of Mashiach, or the revelation of Hashem in the world, has to come from us. It can't be given to us, it must come from us, right? Is such an important concept generally in our life. And what it leads in is to the topic of responsibility. See, we bring Hashem into the world by living a life of purpose. Obviously, in Yiddishkeit, purpose means the purpose of Torah, mitzvahs, and serving Hashem. But what that means is that everything we experience is not just about doing a mitzvah here and there. right? The Gemara tells us, "Ani loy nivresi, ela l'shamesh eskoini." I was not created only to serve my master. That is the purpose of life, to live for something higher, to live for something other than ourselves, right? Yes, we can enjoy a good holiday this time of the year. We can have a nice piece of cake once in a while, but it's really, that's not why we're here. We could do that. We're physical people. It's okay. But that's not the focus of life. It is that way in many parts of the world now. But the purpose of life is to live constantly for the purpose of serving Hashem. But purpose means, again, the same idea. Purpose means that we have to discover the purpose. And some experience that we have, it's difficult to find the purpose, right? So I want to share with you something that's actually very beautiful. This particular thing is not Torah, but it's in line with Torah. And it's a piece from Viktor Frankl, which I want to bring into this idea. And I think it's very relevant to what we're going through now as well. So I'm sure you're familiar with Viktor Frankl's work. Viktor Frankl had a whole thing called logotherapy, where he believed the answer to happiness, the answer to healing, the answer to well-being is purpose, living a life of purpose. Because he said he came up with this thing that even before the war, he came up with this thing that every person has an innate desire to live a life of purpose. And in fact, when you don't live a life of purpose, you have unhappiness, because it's an unfulfilled need, right? What people often do is, when they're unhappy, so they fill it. If they're not looking for purpose, if they're living a meaningless life, then they will try to fill the void with pleasure. And what that does is, pleasure is very transient and doesn't actually fill the gap, and therefore becomes even more unhappy, right? That's what we know. Today, there's a lot of pressure around, but there's also a lot of unhappiness, a huge amount of unhappiness, especially in Western societies, right? So, and this is what he taught, and this is what he did. Now, it's interesting, I just recently discovered YouTube videos of him. He has a famous book, Man's Social Meaning, of course, which people know, bestseller, which incidentally he almost didn't publish, because it's an interesting story, actually. Just after the war, even before the war, but even just after the war as well, when he was in Austria, he was being shunned. Today he's a big hero, actually becoming less of a hero, but he was being shunned because he deviated from his teacher, which was Freud, right? Freud is the father of modern psychology, and Freud didn't think that the foundation of a human being is to live a life of purpose. He believed that the basis of a human being is to live for pleasure, so, which was the complete opposite. So he went away from that, and he was completely rejected. So much so that he almost gave up. He almost gave up. He lived in Austria after the war, and he almost gave up, and in fact, he was going to come live in Australia because he had a sister here. Interesting fun fact. I'll tell you an amazing story just while we're on it, because I want to just bring it out, the idea. It's actually an amazing story, which was then verified from the Chabad Shliach in Austria, that told an amazing story about the Rebbe and Viktor Frankl, the Bavitcher Rebbe and Viktor Frankl. And I mean, if you know it, I'll say it just in case you don't know it, it's beautiful. But so there was a woman who, after the war, went in to see the Rebbe. She liked to travel. She was a Holocaust survivor. She'd come from a very Hasidic family, whole thing. And the Rebbe, she was traveling, and the Rebbe said, "Are you going to Austria by any chance?" Right? So she said she was on her attorney eventually. And there's a whole story, the lead up to that, but the Rebbe said, "I have a very important mission for you to do in Austria." And she said, "What is it?" He said, "When you go to Austria, I want you to go and visit Viktor Frankl, who was living in Austria at the time, and give him a message from me that he should not give up, he should keep going." So she did. She went there. And she eventually got to the house of Viktor Frankl. It wasn't so simple to get in. He was living sort of more alone at that time. He had remarried after the war. Not to a Jewish woman, actually. But he was there. And he said she said that she has a very, very important mission. A very great man. She was let in. And she gave that message to Viktor Frankl. He didn't give up at the end. He actually pushed through and became very famous. The Rebbe was a very, very... The Rebbe often told people to actually refer people to the therapies of Viktor Frankl, because the Rebbe was... Not that it's learning Torah, and it's not that it's a Torah approach, but it's in line with Torah. The idea of living with meaning is the foundation of Judaism. Why I say it's not necessarily Torah, because his definition, although he admitted that religion is the best form of purpose, but he wasn't talking about Torah specifically, right? Although, by the way, he kept his Yiddishkeit although he was married to an Jewish woman, interesting enough, there's a biography of his. They discovered that he put on tefillin his whole life. He had a siddur and he said Shema every day, which is quite amazing. Anyway, so but he has different levels. He explains different layers of purpose and so on. When the Chabad Shliach moved to Austria, Viktor Frankl was still alive. His name is Rabbi Biederman. And every year he would send out the Chabad calendar to the database of the whole Jewish community. He didn't know Viktor Frankl. But he would send one. He was on the database, so he got one as well. And he never understood why every single year Viktor Frankl would send him a donation. What does he say? I have to do with him. Yeah. One day this woman who had originally come to Viktor Frankl met Rabbi Biederman. And she told him, "You think you're the first shaliach in Austria? You're not the first emissary of the Rebbe in Austria. I am." "What do you mean? I didn't even know." She told him the story that I was the first one who had a mission from the Rebbe to Austria. So she was joking with him, like, "Don't think you're the first. I'm the first." Okay. And he really wanted to actually like verify the story a little bit. Yeah. So he decided he's going to try to call Viktor Frankl. He was very old then already. So he called. He found the number and he called. And Viktor Frankl actually answered the phone. And he says, "This is Rabbi Biederman." And he could see he was like very irritated. He didn't want to speak. But he said, "I'm a shaliach. I'm an emissary from the Lubavitcher Rebbe." And suddenly his demeanor changed over the phone. And he said, He said, "He helped me in a very critical time," which was a reflection of that story, that when the Rebbe sent him a message, that he didn't give up because of that. Anyway. So he's a lot of his views, and I've heard of YouTubes of him where he explains why he came up with this whole therapy, and he came up responding to a society which he believed was going the wrong direction. And it's quite fascinating because he talks about that society, and it's amazing to watch. You can go on YouTube, you can see there's a lot of lectures of him, interviews and lectures and stuff. And he's responding to a society that is our society, just our society is on steroids. Like, he's talking about people that for pleasure, he's talking about the rise of mental health. I mean, if he's talking about the rise of mental health issues, I mean, what could we say today, right? And even the rise of suicide, all these kind of things. And he says a lot of it has to do because people are not living a life of meaning. Then he became very popular, and because of him, many other theories came, which are also in line with Torah, like CBT and positive psychology, which also fake focus on being giving and happiness coming from giving and contentment coming from meaning and purpose. And then in the last number of years, we've like turned the corner again, and now we've brought back all the old nonsense. That's why I think it's so important to actually bring his stuff back from a psychological point of view, because it's really so much more healthy and just so much more in line with Torah. So I came across, this is a bit of introductions, I came across a lecture that he gave once, a motivational lecture, which he gave once, and it was on responsibility, purpose, and freedom. I'm going to go through the whole thing now, but it's such beautiful words. I'm going to read you some of them because it's really about how you get to this idea of understanding that we need to own the process, what we said before. We need to bring Mashiach. We need to take ownership of what we are doing. We cannot blame other people. We cannot become victims. We cannot have excuses. I'm not doing this because, I don't know, someone did something to me or I'm experiencing something. And this is a very hard thing sometimes. But nevertheless, it's all about, he says, purpose can only come when we first take responsibility. We can only live with purpose if we first take responsibility. I want to just read you a couple of lines because they're very beautiful. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Purpose, Freedom, and Responsibility of Viktor Frankl. So he says, I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs. "There comes a moment in every life where pain strikes without warning." I'm highlighting that because I think that's what we're experiencing now, right? "Where we are blindsided by loss, injustice, or betrayal. In those moments, we feel powerless, wounded, broken, right? And it's easy to believe that we are nothing more than victims of fate, caught in a story that we did not write." Yeah. But he says, what if that is not the whole truth? What if even in the darkest hour, we hold a quiet, hidden power, not to erase what has been done, but to decide how we respond to it? Okay. What if responsibility is the very thing that lifts us from the ruins of suffering and turns our wounds into something more than sorrow? And then he says the following. He says, responsibility precedes meaning, right? It is through the acceptance of responsibility that meaning begins to take form. He says a person can search endlessly for purpose, right? Reading books, chasing experiences, pursuing goals. But until they confront what they are willing to be responsible for, the search remains abstract and incomplete. Meaning is not something that floats freely, waiting to be discovered like a hidden treasure. It is forged through the decisions we make to shoulder what is difficult, to carry what is ours, and sometimes even what is not ours, but still needs to be carried. At the core of the human experience is not the question, what can I take from life, but rather, what does life demand of me? Right, such beautiful words, and so in line with Torah. Now, the concept is like this, right? And this is where part of Viktor Frankl's thing was, and there's also an interesting book that came out more recently, by Edith Eger, called The Gift. They're very, very good. They're in line with Viktor Frankl. Very good stuff, right? And one of the themes that underlines this is that at the end of the day, no matter how difficult it is, we are never victims. No matter what happens to us, as hard as it could be, and these are very difficult things, and it doesn't happen right away. But anything that happens to us personally or to a community, we can't become a victim. We can't just go back and say, oh, if this would have been happening, it might be true, we need to do what we need to do, but that's not the point. Point is, how do we respond? And how do we respond means we take responsibility. It means if I'm experiencing this, if it's happening around me, then I have to find purpose. Not that I have to explain what happens. We spoke about this the other day. God forbid, we're not trying to explain or justify or find reasons, because that's so beyond us. We don't know, and we shouldn't know. We should never know. But we do have to respond, right? Because this is the point, right? And we talk about a little bit on Shabbos. Point is that everything that happens in this world is from Hashem. Now, we don't like that sometimes, because sometimes we, you know, there's a story of the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe. He was with a few of his colleagues, and they posed the question, the question was that everyone had to ask themselves, what would I do if I was Hashem, if I was God? Right? So of course, the regular response is, the one guy says, if I was God, everyone would have parnasa. No one would struggle. The other one says, if I was God, everything would, people wouldn't have health problems, wouldn't have tragedy. And so it went, until it came to the Alter Rebbe himself. And the Alter Rebbe himself said, if I was God, I would do exactly what God does. Because saying I would do this means we're talking from our frame of reference. And our frame of reference is very limited. It's a good frame of reference, is what we should be davening for. It's how we should be behaving and asking for and hoping for. But it's not Hashem's world. Hashem has a different world. We don't know that world. And that's fine. What we do know is that everything happens from Hashem. Not only happens from Hashem, that's the principle that Baal Shem Tov taught, that there's nothing happens in this world that isn't Hashgacha Pratis, even isn't by divine providence. And we might have questions that might be very painful, but also the Baal Shem Tov taught, in line with what we've been saying, that everything that happens is not only by divine providence, but it's by divine providence as part of the general puzzle. It's a piece of the puzzle, the overall purpose of creation. Anything that happens means we can use that experience to finish the invitation that Hashem should make a dwelling place in this world. Which means, therefore, to put it in more modern terms, everything that happens, the response can never be victimhood, the response has to be responsibility. If it happened to me, it's my question, what do I do with this? I own it now. I don't understand it, I didn't want it, but it's mine. And I have to bring purpose to it somehow. And not only have to bring purpose, after bring purpose, it might take a lot of hard work, and it might, but then it will last. Not just purpose in the moment. Not just for, and I think this is something we have to tell ourselves more and more now. Not just for a few weeks to do extra mitzvahs because something terrible happened. But we have to take upon ourselves something and respond, and something that we can give purpose to this, each one in their own way, each one in their own mitzvah, in their own whatever journey, in Torah mitzvahs, but that's something that we can hang on to for a long time. To last, because that's why Hashem didn't tell Yaakov, because he didn't want to inspire us, he wanted us to work hard on our own. Right? And that's why, to really achieve purpose, and we have to achieve purpose, he says it in general terms, but actually it's the foundation of Yiddishkeit in the context of serving Hashem. Everything has to be about serving Hashem. For everything we can find some purpose that's connected to the way we serve Hashem. But in order to do that, we have to take responsibility of what happens to us. That's our journey, and therefore we have to respond. And just to finish off, he then talks about, because that approach is actually a choice. We make the choice, hence Edith's book, The Choice, right? It's actually up to us, because we have freedom. We have freedom of choice. It's fundamental to Yiddishkeit. We don't have freedom of what happens. And also, freedom of choice means we have freedom to choose the right thing. And yes, I'll just read you one more little part about freedom. He says, freedom is often misunderstood. It's commonly seen as the ability to do whatever we want, whenever we want, free from obligation, free from constraint, right? That's where our society defines freedom. He says it's a shallow meaning of freedom. Freedom without because freedom must come from responsibility. He says freedom without responsibility becomes indulgent, drifting, chaos. It loses its moral core, its soul, right? When a person is extremely free but refuses responsibility, their choices lose value. Nothing is anchored. Every decision becomes arbitrary. Such freedom does not elevate the person, it diminishes them. Really, he doesn't say this, but actually really what it does is it traps them. That kind of freedom means you become more and more trapped within yourself. It's actually not freedom. It's being imprisoned in your own devices, in your own temptations, right? He says it becomes like a leaf in the wind, moving but going nowhere. Responsibility is what gives freedom substance. It allows us to say, listen to this line, I will not just be free from something, I will be free for something. Which is a beautiful one, right? The shift changes everything. And that's what freedom is. Freedom is that I experience something, I take responsibility. I take responsibility for what? To achieve purpose. How do I achieve the purpose? That's my freedom of choice. That's my choice. I can do it. And that's Viktor Frankl's story where he said that even in the camps, he was able to be free because he made a choice to be free in his mind, at least. He couldn't change the circumstances, but he could change his own attitude. And that's why he says, it's not just about being free from constraints, it's about being free for something and creating the inner freedom. And that becomes then the way to actually achieve the purpose. So going back to the beginning of the parasha, I think that's now our responsibility. We just witnessed something absolutely horrific that we should never, ever, ever see again, even a little bit of it. But it did happen, and we don't understand, and we confused and maybe even angry. But our response needs to be responsibility. We have to find purpose, but we can only find purpose if we own the story. It becomes our story with time, and we say, what am I going to do with this? Because I have to bring Mashiach, because I have to do it, and I have to invite Hashem, not from some inspiration from outside, but I have to do it from within, and that happens. But in Mirz Hashem, we'll do that, and it's almost finished. He's coming soon, very soon. Mirz Hashem, it should happen. Now, thank you very much, everyone, for joining. I'm sorry I'll give you an early break, but I actually have to run somewhere.